White Network presents. The International Jews Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, we had a little problem. We were having some sound problem and Hanning hung up to reconnect, and then the whole thing went haywire.
It's all my fault.
No, it's not your fault. It's our little system here. But I think that Tan Steffel got my message, and he got it started again. So here we are. We're going fine. Let me just say good evening to you all, listeners and students of the International Jew, and remind you that this is February 21st, 2013. This is episode 35. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hanning Scott.
Yeah, okay. We got to go through our little deal here to make it right, and he can always cut out the beginning there where there was dead air for the downloads. Okay, so tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're continuing with chapter 30 that we began last week. Its title is How Jews Capitalized a Protest Against Jews. You know, we finished the previous chapter about the rise of the Jewish Theatrical Trust, and so we went ahead and started chapter 30, and we did about 10 or 11 paragraphs of that, and it was This chapter is about how another group of Jews got control from the Jews that had the control of the American theater. So it didn't change, you know, it changed things, a lot of things changed, but the Jews were still in charge of it all. Now, to go over what we said what we read last week at the beginning of this chapter, it was about Morris Guest, a Russian Jew, and his abominable taste in theater productions, according to the International Jew. Yet he was the most advertised man in the theatrical world at the time. And he was also the father-in-law of David Belasco, who we're going to hear quite a bit about tonight. And he's another Jew in the theater business. Another character is Sam Harris, whose tastes were formed at ringside, they said, in the prize-fighting world. And then there was Al H. Woods, who was once a member of an East Side gang and played the piano in a downtown joint. So this is the kind of people that have gotten into the theater in New York. And they said that the complete Judaization of the theater occurred when it became, quote, show business, unquote. The ideal became, with the emphasis on business.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ideal became to pander to depravity. The Jewish managers and producers also employed Jewish actors and actresses wherever possible, even when it didn't really fit. Like they had an example of the Jewess with pronounced racial features who played a young Christian girl from the early Christian period. And finally, a number of names of Jewish stars in the theater were given, and it was said that there were others whose Jewish identity was not revealed by their names, and it was not publicly known that they were Jewish, but they were Jewish too. And so in this chapter, you know, I noticed, Hanning, there was a lot of irony. So I thought I'd alert the listeners to expect that as you're reading.
Irony alert! Irony alert!
Okay.
Okay.
Your turn.
This is irony. All right, I begin reading. The Jewish press claims for the Jews, aside from the commercial control of the stage, the control of the fun-making business. The greatest entertainers, vaudevillians, and fun-makers are Jews, says an article in the Chicago Jewish Sentinel, commenting on the extent to which Jewish actors monopolized the Chicago stage that week. Among the composers we once beheld Victor Herbert and Gustav Kircher in honorable places. But now the Irving Berlins have forced themselves into places hewn out and established by Gentiles who had a regard for art. Now, Victor Herbert, of course, you know what he's done, right?
Yes. Sort of.
He did the music for Babes in Toyland, which, you know, a standout composition from that is March of the Wooden Soldiers. Mm-hmm. And Gustav Kerker, I just looked him up. He wrote, his biggest hit apparently was something called The Belle of New York.
Oh, yeah, that was a big hit.
Both of these men studied music in Germany. Victor Herbert was Irish by birth. Gustav Kerker was German himself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are no great Jewish playwrights. Charles Klein wrote The Lion and the Mouse, but never repeated. There is, of course, much commonplace work turned out for the stage. A commercialized stage needs a certain amount of product. Among those engaged in such work are Jack Late, Montague Glass, Samuel Shipman, Jules Eckert Goodman, Aaron Hoffman, and others. Turning out product. The Jewish claim to exceptional genius is not borne out by the theater, although the Jewish will to power is therein amply demonstrated. Illustrated, it says. Belasco's name comes to mind, perhaps oftener than any. And Belasco is the most consummate actor off any stage.
I think it's funny they say off any stage. They don't say on any stage.
Yeah.
That's pretty ironic.
Maybe.
Yeah.
To understand Mr. Belasco is to understand the method by which the independents fought the Jewish Theater Trust and still retained the monopoly of the theater for the Jews. That word independence was in quotation marks. Irony alert.
Right.
Yeah. The old trust was bowling along merrily, smashing everything in its way, thrusting honored stars into obscurity, blocking the path of promising playwrights, putting out of business all actors who would not prostitute art to commercialism. And there occurred what always occurs, for even the Jews are not superior to natural law, a bad case of big head was developed. Klaw, Erlanger, and their immediate associates felt themselves to be kings and began to exhibit a few supposedly royal idiosyncrasies. There were some protests, of course, against the arrogance of the czars of the theater. The Vanderbilts and other New York millionaires embodied their protest in a movement toward a national theater which was erected at Grand Central Park and for which $1 million was spent, which is probably like $20 million today.
Yeah, I was going to.
One of the members of the trust proved his birth and breeding by saying that this attempt to cleanse the theater was really only a plan to provide a place of vice for the benefit of the millionaire backers. The remark inspired deep rancor, but was more revelatory of the Jewish trust's essential conception of the theater than anything else. Belasco came from San Francisco, where he had done various stunts, including those of an itinerant recitationist, illusionist, and actor. James E. Hearn took an interest in him as a youth and discovered him to be adept in helping himself to dialogues out of printed plays. Helping himself to dialogues out of printed plays. Under Hearn, Belasco learned much about stage effects and soon became very successful in touching up defective plays. Coming to New York, Belasco fell in love with DeMille.
No, he didn't fall in love. He fell in.
What did you just say there?
He didn't fall in love. He just fell in. You said
oh, he fell in. Okay, I have to turn you up here. I can barely hear you. Okay. Oh, yeah, he fell in with DeMille, a Jewish writer for the stage. I guess this was Cecil B. DeMille, maybe.
Sure.
Who only needed...
I don't know. Maybe not. I just assumed it was, but...
Yeah. A Jewish writer for the stage who only needed Belasco's sense of the theater to make his qualities effective. Belasco became a factor in enlarging the Jewish control of the stage in this way. He was connected with the Frohmans, but was unable to persuade them that Mrs. Leslie Carter, who had been the center of a sensational divorce suit and who had placed herself under Mr. Belasco's professional direction, was a great actress. The making of a star out of Mrs. Carter and the gaining of public recognition for her proved a long task. The Frohmans were unsympathetic. Then, among the managers, there was dissension, too. The Schuberts had been compelled to take the leavings of the other Jewish magnates, especially the leavings of Charles Frohman, and the Schuberts revolted. The Schuberts were natives of Syracuse, New York, no doubt, and their preparation for the theater was not promising of their devotion to art. They were program boys and ushers. Then the haberdashery business claimed them as possibly a speedier course to wealth. So they moved from being theater ushers into hat business. Samuel Schubert eventually became a ticket seller in the box office. In due time, having learned a few marketable secrets of the theater, he launched a frivolous burlesque and comedy show. With this, he floated into New York and continued with his musical shows of a shallow kind until the name Schubert has come to be descriptive of the productions. The Schuberts, of course, booked in trust theaters. Theaters belonging to the theater trust. About the year 1900, the Schuberts quarreled with the trust, and Belasco quarreled with the Frohmans. And the two hailed each other as fellow belligerents and proceeded to see what could be made of their belligerency. The public was showing signs of disgust with the trust. That was the cue. The Schuberts and Belasco would appeal to the public to help in the fight against the trust. Belasco and the Schuberts would play the part of injured independents. Public sympathy would be aroused. And public patronage would boost the independents into the strength of a new trust. That is exactly what happened. Belasco's theatricalism helped to this end. He is an actor off as well as on the stage. He affects the pose of a benevolent priest and dresses the part wearing a priestly collar with clerical vest and coat.
And that's he's a weird. Jew. He's
yeah,
Jewish.
This is
and he
weirdest.
Never denied he was Jewish. I know him. He is. It is weird. Oh, it sits right here. I shouldn't have interrupted.
That's weird. I mean, you'd think somebody like that would, they might get a visit from men in white coats, you know? Mm-hmm. Although of Portuguese Hebraic origin, in other words, he's a Sephardic Jew, Belasco dresses after this manner to honor, as he says, a tutor of his early days. Anyway, the costume is very effective, especially with the ladies. He has a tremulous, shy way about him, and he sits in his sanctum with the lights so arranged that his priestly face and splendid shock of silver hair seem to rise out of an encompassing and shadowy mystery. It is very effective. Very effective. One woman declared, after being admitted to the presence and gazing on the face that rose out of the shadows into the light. You want to read that?
All right. I have a better understanding of the divine humility of Jesus Christ since I have been privileged to meet Mr. Belasco.
Thus, the master, as he is called, was well equipped to appeal to public sympathy. And he did appeal. There was no end to his appeal. He told stories of personal attacks made on him. He wrung his hands in desperate grief against the trust's menace to the stage. His own productions, however, were not all immaculate. There was one, Naughty Anthony, which brought the police censor down upon him. But there was a very clear conception in the public mind as to what the trust had done to the stage. Belasco said he was against the trust, and the rest was snap judgment. You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking he was trying to... I think he wanted people to assume that he was a Catholic priest.
Well, you know, and the fact that people accepted all this, and like you say, nobody in a white coat came for him, shows that, you know, that you can be quite eccentric if you're a theater person or an artiste, you know. In that time, probably more than now, because people didn't have all that information about you that we get on everybody now. And so people were a little more, you know, they just knew what they were, what the image was. And also, what I'm wondering is, was this guy ever married? Did he ever have children? Or was he a single man? Because he sounds like he might be a little queer.
The Schuberts and Belasco thus found themselves in a very favorable combination of circumstances. Their first financial aid came, strangely enough, through ex-Congressman Reinach, a Jew, Boss Cox of Ohio, and others who were interested. These supplied the first money. The Schuberts supplied the management. Belasco supplied the wonderful impersonation of a Daniel come to call the Jewish Theater Trust to judgment. The campaign succeeded and the wealth rolled in. For a time, Belasco did prove to the public that he could produce better plays than the old trust had given to the public. And to that extent, he justified public confidence in him. The end of the old trust came in a natural way. The Schuberts became rich and powerful, and the trust was then willing to do business with them. Some of the trust members died, and about 1910, the old trust ceased to exist as the dominant factor in American theatrical affairs. But the rise of the independents did not bring relief. It only captured for Jewish enterprise that part of the theater which might have become the prize of a legitimate body of protesters against the old cheapness and vulgarity. The pretended protest won. The theater was saved to Jewish control. Jewish managers had created the public disgust in the first place. They knew what the public reaction would be, so they prepared to capitalize the reaction, and thus control the theater-going public, both going and coming. This they did with admirable strategy. During the outbreak, there was some genuine feeling of independence on the part of a few non-Jewish managers. John Court organized a Western theater circuit. Colonel Henry W. Savage swung loose from Claw and Erlanger, as did also William A. Brady. But independence of the Jewish control has never flourished. Wherever it did keep up an independent front, it stood for the theater in its best sense and served as the only channel of expression for the remaining few stage artists. The coming of the motion picture, however, gave true independence its quietus. The motion picture industry, and it is rightly named an industry, is entirely Jewish controlled. And as it is pushing its way into the legitimate theaters and crowding out human players for long periods every year, theater managers have to bow to it more and more.
You know, when you brought up the independence of the Jewish control has never flourished, or that anybody being independent of the Jews in the theater never flourished, it's like in Hollywood. And I mean, I'm thinking of Mel Gibson, who is, you know, set himself apart from the Jewish control of Hollywood, but he doesn't flourish really. He has a lot of problems with them, and he doesn't even go all the way with it. And I don't know of any others, but we will be getting into motion pictures in the upcoming chapters. But you know, it's that's where we see it's just totally, it's where you can really see it. I mean, it's just only grown in the entire entertainment industry. Everything is called an industry. Well, I guess it didn't used to be when it wasn't Jewish.
It's a business.
Yeah, show business. And you know, I was going to say last week that they have the same thing going on with Holocaust, you know, and whatever happened to the Jews during that period of time. But they call it show a business. Well, yeah. They don't, but other people do. You know,
I think Dr. Forrestone calls it that.
Yeah, right.
You know, it reminds me, I used to be very interested in radio, and there's so much homogenization of radio now compared to a few decades ago. And because it's all done according to statistics. And, you know, when you have the independent owner of a radio station that doesn't owe any money, then the owner actually will put his personality into the station. He will put on things that he thinks are good.
Uh-huh.
And that has largely been squeezed out of radio.
Yeah, well, that's what we do here at the White Network, Hattie. We do what we think is good.
Yeah.
Because we're independent.
Yeah. It remained for the Schuberts, however, to give the theatrical business a most original twist. They made it a real estate speculation. Readers of this article may recall that recently they have read that in their own or a neighboring city, the Schuberts are going to build one or two theaters. In one city, the announcement was made that two theaters were to be built. That particular city happens to need almost everything else but theaters. However, it cannot get anything else that it needs, and there is no doubt that it will get the theaters. The Schuberts learned this trick when they were supposed to be bucking the trust. They went after any building they could get, and because of the public enmity to the trust, they got better terms than otherwise could have been possible. An old riding school in New York became the Winter Garden, the Great Hippodrome. The materialized dream of a non-Jew, Frederick Thompson, was taken over by the Schuberts. It soon dawned on the Schuberts that there was more money in theatrical real estate, than in theatrical art. Today, the Schuberts, while nominally theatrical managers, are really dealers in theatrical leases and buildings where theatrical productions are made. A theater, as a real estate proposition, pays amazingly well. Figure up the amount of space you occupy at a show, the length of time you occupy it, and the price you pay for it. It is rent raised to the nth degree. Then the offices, which make the bulk of the structure, and the stores in front. Really, the show business is the minor consideration. What does it cost the Schuberts? Very little, but the use of their name. When it is the matter of a new theater, outside capital supplies 3/4 of the money, but the lease and the control are vested in the Schuberts. That is a rather handsome arrangement. In the matter of producing plays, the same arrangement is often followed, the author, the star, or their backers supplying the larger part, sometimes all of the capital, while the Schuberts lend their name to the management and take their share of the booking fees and the rental of the theaters where the show is produced. In October of last year, 1920, a serious slump hit the theatrical business. Even in New York, the theaters were experiencing the worst depression of years. More than 3,000 actors were idle, and managers were compelled to resort to the cut-rate ticket agents to sell their seats. And yet, in the midst of it, Schubert announced 6 new theaters for New York alone. At the same time, they announced the production of 40 plays. 40 plays! If a man announced that he was going to build 6 new art museums in one city and fit them up with the requisite number of oil paintings produced under his own direction, he would be considered crazy, especially if it were a matter of common repute that he knew nothing of art and was having the pictures painted merely to give value to his real estate. It indicates how thoroughly accustomed to the public has become to the show business and the motion picture industry that the announcement of these former haberdashers is taken so complacently. 40 plays! When anyone can count on the fingers of both hands, all the present-day American and English playwrights even remotely deserving of notice. It is said that the Schuberts do not expect more than 3 out of 40 plays to succeed. The success of a play, in the artistic sense, is not their business. To maintain enough plays on the road to keep alive their real estate investments is really the thing. Thus it is now not strange where theatrical slang comes from. An actor who wins success is said to have delivered the goods. An approved actress is all wool and a yard wide. An author puts it over his audience. A girl of no particular class is a skirt. A young chorus girl is a broiler or a chicken. An actress who plays the part of an adventuress is a vamp. A very successful play is a knockout. Taken altogether, it is the show business. This is the effect of Jewish control of any profession, as any American lawyer will tell you. The only protest now being offered is by the small dramatic clubs, which, whether or not they know it, are the strongest anti-Semitic influence on the theatrical horizon.
Mm-hmm. Well, yep, that's the end. It was came out in the Dearborn Independent on 22nd January 1921. I just wanted to comment here because I think this last part is so important, and it teaches us, particularly showing how the Schuberts managed their theatrical business and started making more money in the real estate and so on. It's just a perfect example of the Jewish approach to everything, where they're looking for the maximum profit with minimum cost to themselves, or, in other words, minimum sacrifice, also. And they're just, you know, seeking that out. They do that naturally and they find it. And whereas I can't imagine, if I were in the theater, I'd be thinking about, again, like they say here, the artistic quality, I'd be thinking about how well I was doing things and how I would be seen, you know, in future generations maybe, or just by the people at the time. You just naturally do that with everything. And yet these Jews don't. They have a whole different idea about it.
Yeah.
And we need to understand that.
Yeah, they subverted the whole thing there. They turned the whole thing into nothing but a cash cow, as it's described here.
Yeah, and pandering to the lowest tastes of the public. And there's no doubt that the public likes shocking stuff and, anything titillating stuff if you're going to provide it to them. And so they pander to that instead of trying to lift up people or have any real feeling for what's considered art. And this is how they, it's not just in theater and entertainment, it's in every area, you know, even finance, everything, they do this. And we need to understand how they're doing what they do and point it out. And we just, you know, we got to quit making these excuses for these Jews and talking about they're so successful, they're so smart, you know, oh, look at, and people enjoy their entertainment. But if they had better entertainment, you know, they might go to that. There used to be, even on television, there used to be in the beginning better entertainment and real plays and things put on. Mm-hmm. And everybody enjoyed it. But then they, you know, it just got to be what it has become, which is really disgusting now, or just beyond shocking. With mm-hmm. Think about it. I don't see it, but.
Well, what I what it makes me think about is, if you're producing a large number of plays, you practically have to reduce everything to a formula. And yeah. You have to go for the easiest way to get people to come and see it, which might be appealing to the lowest taste. Sigmund Freud was having influence around that time, and Edward Bernays, his nephew, had figured how to mobilize that Freudian idea that people are driven by these base drives. He used that in what he called public relations, which was really like advertising. And maybe that same idea was in the playwright, in the theater business, where they could get more people to come. They could make a production that would get people to attend much more easily if they pulled people's strings in a very base way. That's my
yeah. Theory. And then when we go to the movies, this formula is even more apparent, where they just use formulas, and we even see how they recycle big hits from the past with new more modern or updated style and actors and so on, and because it was worked then, and so it's all formula for success, and they talk about it in that manner. I mean, it's discussed and it's perfectly accepted that the only thing that's important for these people making plays and movies is to make a lot of money. You know, I mean, they talk all the time about, well, what was the cash taken in this week from the top films, you know, and who was the winner, which one made the most money and who's getting richest. That's what it's all about. And nobody expects it to be otherwise. None of us Gentiles. Don't expect it to be otherwise. And that's in all aspects. Well, we're going to go now to chapter 31. This is going to be interesting. The Jewish aspect of the movie problem.
Yes.
Movie in quotes. So the next two chapters are fairly long, and they're both about the movie business. So here we go.
There was once a man named Anthony Comstock, who was the enemy of public lewdness. Of course, he was never popular. No newspaper ever spoke of him without a jeer. He became the stock joke of his time, and it was not very long ago. He died in 1915. It is very noticeable that the men who mocked his life with banal jesting were non-Jews. It is also worth recording that the men who profited from the commercializing of much of the vice which he fought were Jews. It was a very familiar triangle, the morally indignant non-Jew fighting against public lechery, and the Jewish instigators of it hiding behind ribald Gentiles and Gentile newspapers. I found out who this Anthony Comstock was. He was a U.S. Postal Inspector, and he was head of the New York Society for the Prevention of Vice, which in other sources it said New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And apparently he was able to get a law passed that banned sending indecent material through the U.S. mail, and that included information about venereal diseases and contraception, which is kind of interesting. And among the people who attacked him were George Bernard Shaw. Uh-huh. Shaw actually coined the word Comstockery.
Well, so Comstock was kind of like a reformer, and he went a little too far for some people.
Yeah.
And probably not for the Ford family, though.
Yeah.
They were probably right in line with that, but not people like George Bernard Shaw. Okay, well, go ahead. What was this Comstockery?
Comstockery, I mean, it's just like those moral censorship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the fight is still going on. If you will subscribe to a clipping bureau, or if you will look over the press of the country, you will see that the problem of the immoral show has been neither settled nor silenced. In every part of the country, it is intensely alive just now. In almost every state, there are movie censorship bills pending, with the old wet and gambling elements against them, and the awakened part of the decent population in favor of them. Always the Jewish producing firms constituting the silent pressure behind the opposition. This is a grave fact. Standing alone, it would seem to charge a certain Jewish element with intentional gross immorality. But that hardly states the condition. There are two standards in the United States, one ruling very largely in the production of plays, the other reigning, when it does reign, in the general public. One is an Oriental ideal. If you can't go as far as you like, go as far as you can. It gravitates naturally to the flesh and its exposure. Its natural psychic habitat is among the more sensual emotions. I'm not sure that I agree with that. With his view of this, I think there are Jews that get a great deal of satisfaction out of breaking taboos.
Wasn't that what he's talking about here?
Well,
you're just saying they just want to break taboos? That's not really, I would say that they're trying to demoralize and cheapen the sensitivities of the American white people.
There are Jews that like to knock down and destroy moral standards. This was part of the Kabbalistic cult of the 1700s. They were all into breaking moral barriers.
Mm-hmm. But then they give another reason here in this next paragraph.
This Oriental view is essentially different from the Anglo-Saxon, the American view, and it knows this. Thus is the opposition to censorship accounted for. It is not that the producers of Semitic origin have deliberately set out to be bad according to their own standards, but they know that their whole taste and temper are different from the prevailing standards of the American people. And if censorship were established, there would be danger of American standards being officially recognized. And that is what they would prevent. That is what the Jews would prevent. Many of these producers don't know how filthy their stuff is. It is so natural to them. See, that's what I disagree with.
Okay, well, there's a lot of people who do agree with that and who are, and so you're on a different wavelength there, because there's a lot who would say that's exactly it. The Jews are genetically, they say, the way they are, and this is just natural to them to do this, which means that they are different from us, too. And it goes all the way down into their genetic nature. And you say it's just, you would be on the side of those who say it's an ideological difference?
It seems to be deliberate. You know, they have the Old Testament in their religion. They have all that stuff that we have. The prohibitions, moral prohibitions.
Mm-hmm.
But they deliberately break down the moral code.
Well, because it could be because they're that way. They have those prohibitions probably because they needed them. And you might say,
yeah.
And in any case, they're very sensual and easy. They don't take, well, let's say, how do I say this? I sound like a prude. They don't take sexual restraint very well. I mean, they've always been, what do you call that, more advanced in the, you know, sexual freedom and so on.
Well, there are a lot of Jewish sexual deviants, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Like that homosexual advocate out in San Francisco that was arrested with so much child pornography. He was a Jew.
Okay.
That was recent.
Well, we know that they are in charge. They are responsible for all the pornography. They're the ones who are in the pornography. They've made that a business too. The pornography business or industry is Jewish. So, it seems to come natural to them. They're, except for Hugh Hefner, they're behind most of this soft pornography, and they just love this kind of stuff. Yeah. Now, not all of them. Some of them put on a air of being, high class and aristocratic and so on. But lots of stories circle around about these ones, too.
Yeah. Well, we've got a few non-Jewish scumbags that are purveyors of pornography, like Larry Flint. Scarcely an American home has not voiced its complaint against the movies. Perhaps no single method of entertainment has ever received such widespread and unanimous criticism as the movies, for the reason that everywhere their lure and their lasciviousness have been felt.
You know, let me just say here that if you look at the early movies, the silent films and so on, there is all this, I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, suggestion of sexiness and, it seems exaggerated, Some handsome guy shows up and this woman, they fall in love and there's this crazy, looks between them. And then you're led to believe that they're having, their sex, and then this happens and that happens. And a lot of, physical, a lot of women, the women dressed in revealing clothing or half dressed or something. There's an awful lot of that. There was, of course, then the other type somewhat, like we still have today, the Sound of Music type and so on. But, that was there right from the beginning.
Yeah, I've seen some, there were some silent movies that had immoral themes, like adultery and so forth. Mm-hmm. And, where were silent movies that had nudity in them as well. You don't hear much about those silent movies. The ones that they show on TV tend to be, Laurel and Hardy and stuff like that.
Yeah, right.
Maybe Birth of a Nation or something. That stuff that,
well, there are all these vamps, that was when the time of the vamps. And I think this was, it was the women liked to go to these movies, matinees, I guess. And it was just kind of like the romantic novels of today or whatever. I mean, it was sort of a, what they wouldn't do in real life, but they could, get into it, mm-hmm. imagine it while they're watching the movie. Huh.
There are good pictures, of course. It were a pity if that much could not be said. We cling to that statement, as if it might prove a ladder to lift us above the cesspool which the most popular form of public entertainment has become. The case has been stated so often that repetition is needless. Responsible men and organizations have made their protests without results. The moral appeal meets no response in those to whom it is made, because they are able to understand only appeals that touch their material interests. As the matter now stands, the American public is as helpless against the films as it is against any other exaggerated expression of Jewish power. And the American public will continue helpless until it receives such an impression of its helplessness as to shock it into protective action.
Well, that never happened.
Well, eventually there was the Hayes Commission, I think it was called,
right,
where they had the
right,
motion picture standards and
that's right,
the ratings.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think that was like a preemptive measure to prevent actual censorship of movies. In a powerful indictment of the movie tendency and the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures, Frederick Boyd Stevenson writes in the Brooklyn Eagle, "On the other hand, the reels are reeking with filth. They are slimy with sex plays. They are overlapping one another with crime. From bad to worse, these conditions have been growing. The plea is set up that the motion picture industry is the fourth or fifth in the United States, and we must be careful not to disrupt it. A decent photoplay, it is argued, brings gross returns of, say, $100,000, while a successful sex play brings from $250,000 to $2,500,000.
Wow. Wow. All the way back then they were saying that. That was, well, I guess it's been true forever.
Okay. Dr. James Empringham was recently quoted in the New York World as saying, "I attended a meeting of the motion picture owners in New York, and I was the only Christian present. The remainder of the company consisted of 500 unchristian Jews." This James Empringham was a superintendent of the Church Temperance Society, and he was also an Episcopal bishop from a church in Syracuse, New York. I think he was from England originally, from what I read in the New York Times. "Now, there is little wisdom in discoursing against evil in the movies and deliberately closing our eyes to the forces behind the evil. The method of reform must change. In earlier years, when the United States presented a more general Aryan complexion of mind and conscience, it was only necessary to expose the evil to cure it. The evils we suffered were lapses. They were the fruits of moral inertia or drifting. The sharp word of recall stiffened the moral fiber of the guilty parties and cleared up the untoward condition. That is, evildoers of our own general racial type could be shamed into decency, or at least respectability." That's a very important point, I think.
Okay, like so. Like how?
What he's saying is there's a big difference between white people that that do wrong and Jews that do wrong. The white people that do wrong are acting out of character, whereas the Jews that do these things are just being Jews.
Well, that's what I was saying before, earlier in the other chapter, that this is their natural, they might not even realize that they're corrupting something because it's just the way they like it.
Well, I used to know a Jew that would brag about how amoral he was.
Yeah.
Privately, he would do that.
Well, that's my opinion of Jews, right? They are amoral. They are, it doesn't bother them that they are. They don't see that as a problem.
So I just don't accept that they just do this because it doesn't seem immoral to them. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, but it's also natural to them. It's what they like. And the entertainment they've created is probably what they think is good entertainment. I don't mean they think it's uplifting or good for the people, but it's good entertainment because that's the way they are. Just like vaudeville. Of course, they weren't all Jews, but this was the natural, a lot of that vaudeville type stuff or burlesque or whatever is natural to them, particularly if they can use Gentile females doing it. They are icky.
Okay. So it used to be possible to set Gentiles straight just by saying something about what they were doing wrong. "That method is no longer possible. The basic conscience is no longer present to touch. The men now mostly concerned with the production of scenic and dramatic filth are not to be reached that way. They do not believe in the first place that it is filth. They cannot understand in the second place that they are really pandering to and increasing human depravity. When there does reach their mentalities, the force of protest, it strikes them as being very funny. They cannot understand it. They explain it as due to morbidity, jealousy, or, as we hear now, anti-Semitism. Reader, beware. If you so much as resent the filth of the mass of the movies, you will fall under the judgment of anti-Semitism. The movies are of Jewish production. If you fight filth, the fight carries you straight into the Jewish camp, because the majority of the producers are there. And then you are attacking the Jews. If the Jews would throw out of their camp the men and methods that so continuously bring shame upon the Jewish name, this fight for decency could be conducted without so much racial reference. An analysis of the motion picture industry in the United States will show that 90% of the production of pictures is in the hands of 10 large concerns located in New York City and Los Angeles. That each of these has under it a number of complete units making up the large aggregate of companies seen in photoplays all over the world. That these parent concerns control the market. That 85% of these parent concerns are in the hands of Jews. That they constitute an invincible centralized organization, which distributes its products to tens of thousands of exhibitors, the majority of whom are Jews of an inferior type. That the independent motion pictures have no distributing center, but sell in the open market. So, in other words, the Jews are very organized, and that's how they were able to dominate the film industry. You know, organization is a factor that people don't take into account.
Go ahead.
They say there are only so few Jews. How can they possibly have so much power? It's because they're very organized.
And that's why we need to organize better. We don't have that gift they do. A lot of whites have very good organizational skills, but we're just a different kind of a people, and there's more of us and more spread out, so it's easier for them. But anyway, that's the secret of it. We've mentioned that several times on this program, Hadding. It always comes back to that.
Yeah. Well, as he just said a couple of paragraphs ago, the people have to understand first that they are under attack or that they're in danger before they will organize to take care of it.
Yeah, but there's a lot of us who do know that, and we're the ones I'm thinking about. These are the people who should organize.
Yeah. It may come as a surprise to many people that there is no dearth of good pictures. The trouble is that there is no means by which good pictures can reach the public. One of the notable libraries of beautiful pictures, containing the cream of dramatic and educational films, has been rendered absolutely useless because of the impossibility of getting them before the public. The owners of these pictures achieved a little advance by engaging Jewish salesmen to push their pictures, but against them has always been the huge and silent force of that concentrated opposition which is apparently against the introduction of decency and delight into the screen world. Once in a while, an independent producer like David Wark Griffith or Charles Ray gives the world a screen production that is not only without offense or propaganda, but is a veritable delight and joy. These pictures, with their attendant success, are the strongest answers that can be made to the cry of some producers that the only profitable plays are the nasty ones. That cry, of course, is based on fact. Without doubt, as things now go, the nasty pictures are the more profitable, because they are the most elaborately made and the most gorgeously advertised. The very lewdest of them have secured their patronage by advertising that they deal with moral problems.
Yeah, that's how they do it. You know, I can't put the words together right now, but that's how they say that these things are showing us some kind of a moral problem in our society that we need to deal with.
Yeah, I often get the impression when I see or hear a presentation about some alleged moral problem that it's really pornography in disguise.
Yeah. No. True.
But all public taste is cultivated.
Now, let me just say while we broke in here, I'm watching the time, Hadding. It's we've got two minutes 45 seconds right now, but that's that includes the ending music and everything. And I'm not sure we're going to hear our prompt, so I'll let you know. I'm watching it though.
Okay. But all public taste is cultivated. Every city which can boast of public spirit has citizens who spend tens of thousands of dollars annually in an attempt to create a community taste for good music. They succeed to a certain extent, but very rarely do they make it pay. It appears that the work of demoralizing the public taste is far more profitable. And as our whole range of public entertainment outside of the higher musical field has fallen into the hands of groups who do not know what the term art means, it is evident how overwhelming the appeal of the dollar must be. If the public taste is now so fixedly demoralized that the moving picture producers can confidently claim that the public demands what we are giving it, the case is more damning than otherwise. For it is recognized by all detached observers that such a public taste is a most urgent reason why immediate and heroic remedies should be adopted.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if you should start that next paragraph.
Less than
30 seconds. So we are hearing it, and so we will continue this chapter next week, and maybe we can finish this and finish this the next one and complete the motion picture chapters next week. Well, we won't force it, but we'll see. And then get started on the Kahilas. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again. And we will be back next week for sure. Join us.
Hooray, James, hooray, John, bringing up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.